Buenas tardes. Good evening. Bonsoir. And on behalf of the Booksmith, I'd like to welcome you to The Universal Tone, bringing my story to light, Carlos Santana. My name is Ben Fontores. I have had the pleasure of interviewing Carlos through the years, starting in 1972. For various occasions, but never in front of a wonderful, supportive audience. So let's do it. Ladies and gentlemen, guitarist, composer, band leader, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, Grammy grabber, and now author, Carlos Santana.
Hey.
The first official question is, Señor Autor, why did you decide to tackle such an enormous project as a memoir?
Well, thank you for asking that. I wanted this book to be a collection of beautiful stories, but mainly it's an invitation to the personal reader to claim their own light. The word indoctrination is another word for mental slavery. Guilt, shame, judgment, condemnment, fear, and the concept that you're a wretched sinner. That's mental slavery to me. Yeah. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. We are beauty, elegance, excellence, grace, dignity. We are worthy of God's grace. God only sees love. God did not create the word sin nor sacrifice. That was created by a twisted mind and a crooked mind to imprison people like a pimp.
And a lot of your thoughts, this is a really good read, as they say, in book business. And so I want to ask you about the writing process, because you give full credit to two other folks, Ashley Kahn and Hal Miller. Hal Miller, an old, a longtime dear friend of yours. What was the process? Because the book is in your voice. That's one of the great accomplishments of the book. It's conversational, and yet it's intimate, and yet you did it with two collaborators. So how did that work?
By trusting. You know, we both wanted, both Ashley Kahn and Hal Miller and myself, and of course my sister Maria, all of us wanted to take the high road, look at the aerial view, and see the big picture. You know, we wanted to make this book about elevate, transform, and illumine. We don't want to tell people what to do, who to be, or how to do it. May the heavens open up and the angels bless each and every one with the deep awareness of your own light. Yeah. And that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to put together all the stories, wonderful stories that I learned from my dad, Jose Santana, from Bill Graham, Clive Davis, B.B. King, Tito Puente, Miles Davis, John Lee Hooker. You know, I mention these names not because I drop names. It's because I am them. I see myself as part of everything that I learned from them. Now my main teachers is Dolores Huerta and Harry Belafonte.
I've never thought of you as dropping names. I think you've always lifted names higher and into people's consciousness. And I wonder how you were able to call on your memory for details, having done a memoir myself. Man, that is the hardest thing to do, to go back through the flashbacks and beyond, to remember the details of growing up, for example, and how your parents were, how the house was, what the family was like, what it was like in Otlan, and then Tijuana, and then finally San Francisco. How did you do that? How did you dig back?
I learned from my mother. She has an incredible mind that had a supreme gift for detail. I chose in this book to remember only the good stuff. All the bad stuff, I deleted it, and it's not longer a part of my existence. I have celestial and selective memory.
The reason I ask that, too, is because you begin by recalling in detail a parade that you were not around to attend because you were still being born. Josefina was at the parade. But so did your mom then tell you, and you would press her for details and write them down? Did you ever keep a log, a diary?
Yes, right here. I mean, not many books start with a parade on a small little town where my mother heard this barulla, which means crazy noise. She asked, ¿Eso qué es? What is that? My mother's father, Don Refugio, he said, is that Diablo, el farol? And so my mother opened the curtains, and the first thing she sees is a parade with prostitutes and my father holding his violin bow with a bazier in underpants. It's a flag. And the priest wants to throw holy water at them. And the mayor loves it. The mayor of the town loved my dad, you know. So, and I was like, wow, my dad is something else.
What was his music? He played violin.
He played violin, but he mainly played all the music that I heard right now. Agustin Lara, yes. Aquellos Ojos Verdes, Farolito, everything that I learned to play in the violin. You know, at that time, Agustin Lara was what you call the Cole Porter of Mexico at that time, a supreme writer. Mm-hmm. One of the most recorded songs ever is Bésame Mucho, ever.
Sure.
And people don't know that Caesar Salad started in a hotel in Tijuana called Caesar Hotel. People don't know that Margarita or, you know, La Bamba has been recorded even by the Tabernacle Choir. You know, people eat more tortillas or burritos or whatever than bread nowadays. We are here and you can't take it back. Or as we say, órale.
So you were born into a musical family, and your parents, I believe, encouraged you to try the violin. As a 9-year-old, how did you feel about the violin?
Not very well. I didn't like the way it smelled.
Oh.
I didn't like the way it felt, and I definitely didn't like the way it sounded out of my hands. Mm. I sounded like a bad Jack Benny.
He was bad.
Or a whining pussycat in the dark in the night in an alley. Like, you know, so like, yeah,
But you may do with it. You played it for a number of years.
Well, I try to please my dad, but fortunately he was flexible enough to allow me to tell him, I don't want to do this. I want to do it in a different form. Mm. So he bought me an electric guitar.
A small jump from violin to electric guitar. Small jump from Autlan to Tijuana when you were 8 years old,
yes.
With the family, of course. A large family, too, by the way. I believe you wrote that by age 7, there were 7 children.
I think my mother had 11 or 12 children.
11 or 12 total.
But only 7 of us made it.
And in Tijuana, I believe it was that your musical horizons expanded because you had access to music through radio and the jukebox and sound booth. Here is one of the songs that you enjoyed hearing on the radio. The great Perez Prado also had a song called Patricia.
Yes.
Beautiful. Yeah.
S-E-X. That's what that song is all about.
Bésame mucho, baby. As a boy, you endured some very difficult moments, whether it was being hit by your mother or being molested when you weren't even 11. I was wondering how it was for you to have to go through those times for your co-writers for the book. You just said that you focused on the positive and what you could celebrate about your life. And yet, of course, no life is without bumps.
I chose to write about my relationship with my mom, and child molestation is a form of healing. Because there is no healing without forgiveness. I picture in 2008, this person who molested me, and I transfigurate him into a 7-year-old child. And I put him in front of me, and I saw a lot of light like this behind him. And I said, I forgive you, and I'm going to send you back into this light behind you. I'm not going to send you to hell, because it means that I will go there with you. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go to hell, and I'm not going to send you there. So I'm going to offer you complete compassion and forgiveness, and I will never think of you again. And at the same time, I'm able to look at myself in the mirror and say, I am not what happened to me. I am still with purity and innocence. I am as God created me, free from sinlessness.
That takes strength. You heard, besides Perez Prado, you heard all kinds of music on the radio, and you seem to naturally gravitate away from the pop mainstream, the kind of lily white music of the day. And you gravitate instead towards people like Ray Charles and Little Richard and James Brown. When you think back to that, do you know, can you say why you think that your taste went that way?
Because the other stuff was corny and shallow and hollow. You know, and I just, you know, I respect him because he grew up in Tupelo, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. But I don't have one record of Elvis Presley in my house. I understand that he's a king of whatever. Not in my house.
Wait a minute, the king of rock and roll, you mean?
Not in my house. In my house is T-Bone Walker and John Lee Hooker. With all respect to Elvis Presley.
In 1960, your father came to San Francisco to find work, and you stopped playing music for a couple of years, but you kept listening, and you fell in love with electric guitar. How did that romance begin?
It was my mother, always my mother. She grabbed me by the hand and says, Mijo, ven conmigo. I says, come with me. I was like, do I have a choice, you know? Because my mother was very assertive. So she took me to about 2 blocks away to this park in Tijuana, and there was this band called the TJs for the Tijuanenses. And there was this guitar player named Javier Batis who was playing guitar. And he had that tone like B.B. King and Peter Green and Michael Bloomfield. He had that tone. And when I heard that tone, for me, it was like seeing my first flying saucer. It was, my whole existence changed. I knew right there and then that's what I wanted to do and be and nothing else. So I follow him like a puppy everywhere. I wanted to know how he got that thing. For a while, we were good friends. But after a while, I kept hearing that he kept telling everybody that he taught me everything that I know. Mm. So then I decided to go to his source. I saw that he was listening to nothing but B.B. King records. So I got B.B. King records and Otis Rush, and Buddy Guy, and then I found out how to do it. But he didn't teach me a damn thing.
Since you mentioned the Blues Boy from Beale Street, let's hear track number 4 for some nice music. Great B.B. King.
And Bobby Blue Bland.
Yeah. You were in, as we said, Tijuana from age 8 to 15. And as a young teenager, you were already playing at El Convoy, the nightclub, right?
Yes.
Ah, okay. And then your family would move to Northern California, and you would stay behind because you loved the life there in the nightclubs and playing. How did they allow you to do this? You were how old, 12?
I mean, who wouldn't?
Oh, who wouldn't love that life?
Yeah, yes. You know, you play for an hour, and then for another hour, you know, ladies strip.
Oh, yeah, that's
you
right.
Know, I mean, it's like, it's better than Cirque du Soleil, you know? But I mean it in an honorable way, because you do learn how they walk,
Yes.
You know, how they walk, how they carry themselves. And you do learn that there is integrity and elegance because you see them at church on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Dressed in impeccable white, with white candles and their kids, and they bring flowers to God. So they do what they do because they have to feed the children.
Yes.
You know? So I learned to respect prostitutes from the sense that I'm not what I do. There's honor in that.
Yes.
Who was Jesus' favorite companion? Mary Magdalene. And what was she? So we have to honor, you know, everything about God, because God isn't them. God isn't a prostitute as much as he is in the Pope, you know, Dalai Lama or Desmond Tutu. If you don't believe that, you have some issues, because God is everywhere.
Mm. You told me once that Tijuana was the best source of your education. You did go to school there, and then you went to school after your show, and you went to school musically. But the rest of your family came to Northern California. You came here once, and you went to James Lick Junior High.
Yeah.
For a couple of months. And you went back to Tijuana with your father, but you're pretty much on your own for almost a year. And then the story is different depending on who's telling it. You know, it's like Rashomon. You tell it one way. Antonio came and got you. Sometimes it's your father and mom came. Sometimes all three came and cried in front of you to beseech you to join them in Tijuana. Why were you still so resistant with your whole family here to come here?
Because at that time, being in America was difficult for me. Being a child, not even almost a teenager, kind of a teenager, I go to sleep when I want to. You know, I do what I want to, and it wasn't my mom, which is very domineering, telling me what to do and who to be and how to do it. So I had free reins, and coming to here, to San Francisco, I would have to start all over again with junior high school. I couldn't speak English, barely. I think the first words that I learned was, stick him up.
Wow.
Watching Hopalong Cassidy and Gene Autry and Roy Rogers, stick him up. And I was like, stick him up, okay, you know. So when I came here, it was at the peak of West Side Story. It was the Barts and the Jets. No different than the Crips and the Bloods, you know. Gangs will forever be, hopefully not forever. But I came to San Francisco in right about 2 weeks before they shot John F. Kennedy, you know, and my whole existence changed. I was really angry still, and my mother said it again. This time, I'm going to give you some money to go back to Tijuana, but I'm not going to get you back. Because she did kidnap me. My mother and my brother and my brother's friend, they literally kidnapped me back to San Francisco.
Yeah,
I'm so grateful she did, you know? But this time, she says, I won't go after you this time. Mm. And I was like, I walked for about two blocks, and I said, dang. I think I better stay here now, you know. And so I listened to my heart, and I stayed.
Yeah. And you became an American. You became a student at Mission High, although, yes, a couple of years behind, but I'm sure you caught up pretty quickly. You also had a job as a dishwasher at TikTok.
Right next to where the new Giant Stadium is.
Yeah. Right. Look at that. From dishwasher at 3rd and King, national anthem.
Yeah. Thank you.
Of course, by this time, you're pretty fluid with the guitar, and you're knee-deep in the blues and other great music, and so you're ahead of your classmates in terms of wanting to play music in public. And then you begin to get further inspiration because the Fillmore has opened with Bill Graham presenting shows, Chet Helms at the Family Dog, and
yes,
other folks elsewhere, bless them. And so you're expanding your musical vocabulary and world. So yeah, as you say, it was a good thing that you did come here.
Well, what happened, I was working at TikToks one time, and I remember I was reading this comic book about Spider-Man. And even back then it said, with power comes responsibility. And I was like, okay. And then the Grateful Dead pulled in and three limousines. And I'm watching these cats, you know, and I saw them already at the Fillmore. And I'm watching them, and I go, I can do that. I can do that. So I walked up to the thing where you punch the card to quit. And they told me, I'm going to quit, man. I know what I'm going to do, and I'm going to be. And they dare me. He says, well, if you quit, you know, the union, and, you know, they won't pay. I says, you'll never see me again unless I come to eat one of those nasty hamburgers that you do. I quit. I quit that day, you know.
Wow.
But, you know, I'm not saying it from the point of anything other than conviction. I respect Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. I just felt that I belong like them and Michael Bloomfield on stage at the Fillmore. And I do encourage you, you know, to crystallize your convictions and shake away fear, you know, and go after it. If you see a vision, even right now, people say, oh, isn't it hard now for people to, like, no? Because it's the same universe and same God who will give you your aspirations. Mm-hmm. So don't use excuses, someone else's excuses.
The thing is, for a dishwasher, you were pretty cocky. You went up to Michael Bloomfield once, didn't you? You recounted in your book, so you must have, and said something to him. And do you remember that encounter?
I always regretted saying it, you know, because I was, all of a sudden, like, Michael Bloomfield came in, and he was such a sweet, adorable dude, you know?
Yeah.
And everybody was, like, just drooling, oh, Michael Bloomfield, Michael Bloomfield, Michael Bloomfield. And it's like 20, 12 people around him, and I was like, I'm sure it was just the undivine ego in me who walked up to him and I said, man, someday I'm going to cut you. And he looked at me and it was like, whoa. And he says, I swear to God, he said, I want you to. He says, go ahead, man. I want you. In other words, when I say I cut you, it means I'm going to achieve what you're achieving. I just didn't have the vocabulary, what they call now tools and skills to communicate. I was just freaking ghetto, you know?
Well, it's a good thing you didn't say stick it up. Yeah. By this time, you are forming what becomes a band. You had met in school, you met Michael Carabello and begun playing with him in the parks and elsewhere. Did you play a Peace and Freedom benefit one time, too?
Many.
Ah.
Many. We play for Dolores Huerta and Cesar Chavez. We play for the Black Panthers. We play for anybody who would allow us to play.
That's how you do it. You get out there and open every door and step on through. You also began to form the band that became Santana. It was originally called the Santana Blues Band, partly because of your love of that form of music and the fact that most of the guys were playing that music. And it was named Santana Blues Band, partly because your name rang better than Haro or Carabello or Rodriguez. And then you had a good first gig and then a disastrous one. And this is the one where you learned some primo lessons from Mr. Bill Graham.
Yeah, you don't want to be on the wrong side of Bill Graham. He cursed children that I had yet to have. He cursed me so bad, man. I was like, oh, and you will never work for me again, and I'm like, because we were late, you know, and it wasn't my fault. Anyone can tell you I'm never late. I'm always like an hour and a half ahead. My father taught me, if you show up on time, you're late.
You have to be
half an hour or 50 minutes. I don't like people who make me wait. I'd leave them. Take a cab, you know.
He was early tonight.
Thank you.
I was late.
But it was both, my mom and dad. That's why I am the way I am. They both instilled in me, never be late. It's disrespectful.
So you were late. Oh, yeah, it was not just that. And you felt bad about it, but some of the other guys had sort of an attitude. They were a little casual about it, I believe, to Mr. Graham. And I think that's why he really took off on you and thought, hey, amateur time here. Don't come back for a while.
Yes, we didn't come back for a while. We started doing everything else, the Panhandle, you know, Head Ashbury, anywhere. Columbus and Grand Green Street, you know, we just played anywhere.
Mm. All this time, you're still sneaking in to Bill Graham's place.
I had to.
Concerts.
I didn't have any money. I need to hear Jimi Hendrix and Cream. I want to know how they do it.
And B.B. King.
And of course.
You saw him again in late 1967 and learned or sensed the importance of getting inside oneself. And you say in your book, he got inside the note. Could you explain that?
I was telling this story to Steve Miller because we just did a tour about a year ago in Australia. And it was Otis Rush, Steve Miller, and B.B. King. And B.B. King, which Bill Graham called him the chairman of the board of blues, when he walked up on stage, the band was already playing, and he got a standing ovation from all the hippies. You know, he was standing ovation, screaming. And I was looking at him, and all I could see was this glitter, this shiny stuff, like sunlight on water. And he was shining because he started to cry. I mean, his big old tears were coming out. And he had a ring with a bunch of diamonds called B.B. King. And so all I could see was his tears and these diamonds and people just adoring him the way people adore my dad. And I was like, dang, that's what I want. That's what I want to be. I want to be adored like that. I told the story to him, and he was moved because he remembered, you know. Uh-huh. That changed my life, immediately made me abandon my mom and my sisters and brothers, and I started living in the streets because, you know, it's the same time that happened with the Grateful Dead. It all happened at the same time. I told myself, you will never, ever again be a weekend musician. You will be a full-time musician, even if you have to starve to death. So B.B. King, in that moment, changed my existence again. Yeah. First time through Javier Batis, and this time himself.
You were also expanding your vocabulary with Latin music around this time, and songs like built around congas, like El Watusi, or like Number 5. Let's see if you can name this tune.
Cuba.
Bang, bang. Hey, do you like enjoy going out and dancing?
Yes, very much. Who doesn't? I got to tell you how I came about. Around the same time, I was watching everybody playing the blues. It's like Jimi Hendrix, Cream. They're just playing it louder, but it's still the blues. You know? And most people, when they see Jimi Hendrix or Cream, the feeble ones decide to quit. Oh, I can't do that, so I'm going to quit. Me, I said, I got to find another way that they don't know, you know? So I started listening to Olatunji. And, of course, at that time, I was taking a lot of altering things. And I was living in Potrero Hill, where O.J. Simpson grew up. And I was living in Potrero Hill, and I was under the influence, and I kept hearing this song called Oye Como Va, you know? Mm-hmm. And then I discovered Tito Puente and Eddie Palmieri, and I was like, now, the song that you just played, which is called Bang Bang, is the same song as Hang On Sloopy, La Bamba, Louie Louie. It's the same chord changes, you know? Twist and Shout. Mm-hmm. It's the same chord changes. So I realized they invited me to this picnic in San Jose. And when I got out of the car, I could hear over there, far away, some mariachi music. And over here, some música tropical. At that time, was not called salsa. It was called música tropical. And then over here, some people were playing some rock and roll kind of blues stuff. And I could hear all of it at the same time. And I was like, yeah. Put it all together, uh-huh. You know?
And it was good timing, too, because you continued to play with your band. In the spring of 1968, the Fillmore had just opened auditions. And Santana got to play there again as part of a benefit after about a year away. And Bill Graham heard you, and boy, what an incredible heart and help he was to you and your band. He helped the band with getting a record deal with Columbia. He helped with booking you at his brand new Fillmore West, where your family, by the way, got to see you in action for the first time. He helped you book a trip to the East Coast, lots of exposure there, and with getting on to the bill at this arts festival up on some farm, upstate New York. And boy, did you have fun. And in your book, you talk about the fact that the fun, in one way, began with something that Jerry Garcia handed you.
It was like Alice in Wonderland, you know, when you see the Cheshire Cat who's got this smile, you know, hey, you know. And what time are you going to go on? And I says, three bands after you. He says, we're not going on until like 12 o'clock at night. And I said, oh, so that means we're going to go on at 3 o'clock in the morning. So he says, hey, and then he shows me his hand, and he's got a thing in there. And I was like, okay. I said, you know, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, yeah, I'll be all right by then. Yeah. So I took it, and I didn't realize that after I took it, I immediately came on. And I'm not encouraging people to do it unless you do it under supervision. But it is like a snake shedding his skin.
Yeah.
You get rid of, you know, even Cary Grant took it under supervision, you know. Anyway, when I came on, there was this face going, if you don't play now, you're not going to play. And I was like, oh, damn. And there's 550,000 people. And the band is looking at me like, uh-oh.
Hey, this is all in a movie.
Yeah.
Hey, let's hear his rendition of Soul Sacrifice, Completely Wasted.
Thank you. I have to correct you. I wasn't wasted. You cannot find yourself until you lose yourself. I wasn't wasted.
That did sound a little snaky. You made your first album then in Los Angeles, and it took only about 5 days. And even in the making of that first album in 1969, Bill Graham played a major role. He suggested a song won by a Latin star, Willie Bobo. And in February of 1970, Santana had a hit. We'll sit back and enjoy some music for a little bit here. You went to work on your second album, and what great songs you gathered from many sources, including Peter Green, the great guitarist from the original Fleetwood Mac. Who brought this song to the band?
It was Greg Raleigh. We were doing a sound check on a parking lot in Fresno.
Oh, of course. Of course you would.
And he said, man, I got a song that I want to know if he can do. You know, I said, sure. So he played it. Then we try to interpret it the way, so I said, I'm going to put a little bit of Wes Montgomery, you know, kind of like a chef. I'm going to put it with some Wes Montgomery in here and some Otis Rush and some Los Indios Tabajaras, you know. Those guys don't know nothing about this.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that magic.
She is black and she is magic.
You could tell where the breaks were, yeah. As you say in your book, you turned it into a blues rumba, kind of a rhythm, and it is still the most requested song right now for you in concert?
Smooth.
Of course, yes. The new generation, huh?
Yeah.
And there's Oye Como Va by Tito Puente. You liked it because you wanted music to make women crazy. And
very
then,
important.
One of my favorite all the time was Que Samba Pati, Samba Pati. When you would hear it on the radio, what was your own reaction to it?
It made me realize something that I didn't know till later through Selena. She said, I am the dreams and aspirations of my people. Through Samapati, I represent all the people that the Republicans are trying to keep out. I represent all the people who pick up your food, people who clean the sheets in every hotel from here to New York, the toilets, babysit, gardeners. I am the dreams and aspirations of the invisible voice of people. But I'm also connected now, like Bob Marley, with the rest of the world. I don't just represent brown anymore, you know? We represent the whole rainbow.
Well, it's a lovely song, and you say in the book that it is more me than anything I had recorded. And I think we'd love to hear a bit of it now, still as popular as ever. Definition of beauty right there. And yet, again, as with anything living, there are problems now and again. And with Santana, there was dysfunction. There were difficult moments that caused friction that led to the first cracks and the first departures. Essentially, what happened to that first band?
I mean, everything that Bill Graham said it was going to happen. He said, when you get your first check and then you hear your music on the radio, your heads are going to get so big, you're going to need a shoehorn to get into a room because it won't fit. And, you know, it's the same thing that happens to most bands. You know, you're not ready for this avalanche of adulation and compensation and validation. And at the same time, you realize that your people that you grew up with, they want to give birth to different music than the one that you're doing,
mm-hmm.
which is not more natural normal, like the Beatles or whoever, you know. So we started going different ways, and especially because, you know, I don't want to be around people who do cocaine, period, or heroin. Because when people do cocaine and heroin, makes it very difficult to articulate. You know, I have a different agenda, you know, and they can do whatever they want to do, but not around me, because it delays my mission.
Along comes Rolling Stone and me, and our first meeting was for this cover story in late 1972, which you reminded me was headlined The Resurrection of Carlos Santana. Do you remember doing this story and going through it, because it wound up with lawsuits even, as I recall.
Wow.
You remember that Bill Graham got in trouble for saying some things, you know, in his brutally honest way about the management and the finances of the band? Yeah.
All I remember was the pain of breaking up, you know, uh-huh. from our relationship. It's always painful to break up from our relationship. But I learned, you know, that I, by the grace of God, I become stronger, clearer, and faster.
Mm-hmm.
With getting to, you know, for me, getting to anything is about, I call it spiritual traction. We are all here to make spiritual traction. We are not here to shuck and jive, slip and slide, and make excuses. You know, so this is the first time that I learned that sometimes it's painful to break a relationship, but if you're not aspiring and growing spiritually together, let them go. Let them go. Let her go. Let yourself go. Because then you're crawling, and I don't want to crawl, man. I want to S-O-A-R. I want to soar.
Mm-hmm. You grew as a young adult in so many different ways in terms of new musical adventures, but also just adventures in life. And you met a wonderful woman, Deborah King, yeah. Who shared your life for more than 30 years. 34 years. Wow. And she came from a musical family, too. Maybe that was part of the common chord you had. She was the daughter of a great R&B and blues band leader named Saunders King.
Saunders King, yeah.
Right.
B.B. King called me one time, and he was like, hey, Santana. I says, who's this? He says, it's B.B. King. I said, no, it isn't. No, it's B.B., man, it's B.B. King. He says, listen, why didn't you tell me you were married to Saunders King's daughter? I says, why? He says, when I was a kid, Saunders King was my first god. I was like, really? So, you know, so I just didn't know that Saunders King was the first king before B.B. King, Albert King, and Freddie King, you know.
Well, among the many great things that came from that relationship, aside from a wonderful restaurant, by the way, Dipton Nevis.
Yes.
Yeah, it was in our neighborhood, Diane and mine, on Church and Market, three children. And you wrote a song that is partly dedicated to your firstborn, Salvador. Would that be correct?
The
Blues for Salvador? Well, let's listen to it for a moment, and then we'll talk a bit more.
Thank you.
How life changed for you when you became a family man with Stella and Salvador and Stella and Angelica, or as you call her, Jelly. And you wrote how you would be at home. And as you said, you had to deal with, say, a family dog and what dogs do. And once you told them, man, I'm not supposed to be cleaning dog poo. I'm a rock star.
I like to make fun, you know,
yes.
Of myself, you know, and I had to take myself seriously. You learn from your children just how uncool you could possibly be. Until they get to their 30s, and then they go, oh, man, my dad is so cool, you know.
He is smooth.
But from 17 to 27, they're like, you know, because they know everything, you know, we don't know nothing, you know.
Well, you never stop being cool, but boy, the cool factor upped a little bit when you had a reunion with Mr. Clive Davis. And you had left CBS, you had gone with Polydor, that didn't work out too well, and things got back to your partnership with Clive Davis. And he took a real strong hand in saying, boy, we got to have some hits.
He asked me, do you have the willingness? Now, Clive Davis, willingness is what create miracles. Willingness and allowing, like an eight, laying down. Allow willingness, willingness to allow. If you have those, you're going to go really deep and really far and really high. If you don't have those, you ain't going anywhere. Because willingness means to have an open heart and an open mind. So he says, do you have the willingness to discipline yourself? I came to see you at the Radio Music City Hall and man, you're killing it. He says, live, you're killing it. But in the studio, it's a different discipline to create radio hits. Do you have the willingness to discipline yourself to do this and allow me to bring people who they love you and want to create with you? And then he started naming them, like Babyface and Lauryn Hill and Dave Matthews. And, you know, he started naming everybody. I said, yes, I have the willingness.
Well, the truth is that in your work as a solo artist, you had forged partnerships with many different musicians from jazz, all worlds of music, and so I could see that you would be open to these partnerships. And one of them, Rob Thomas, of course, created, with help from the producers and musicians, gave you your first major, major, major hit in 1999, the first one since those first albums, that is. And let's go back in time. That album, Supernatural, was Supernatural. It sold approximately a jillion records. A jillion, about right, huh? Somewhere between 15 million and a jillion.
That was a lot.
A lot. 10 Grammy nominations. You had an armload of those beauties, 8 altogether. What a wonderful time. And in the album, you had a song, El Faro, for your father. Did your father get to hear and enjoy the success that you had?
No, I was writing that song with my son, Salvador, when the phone rang and Deborah said, you know, someone in your family went away. I go, where did they go? And they said, no, you don't understand. Someone in your family, because we never known death. We never known divorce or death, ever. By 6 months, my mother and father would have been married 60 years. You know, so that's something we didn't know, death or divorce. So I called, and I found out that my dad had just, you know, he left as we were writing the song, El Farol, so he never got to hear it.
I'm sorry to hear that, yeah. So, your relationship with Deborah ended, and years later, you met a drummer. About a dozen years ago, you met a fantastic drummer at a music festival in Germany. And about 4 years ago, you married her. Could you tell us a little bit about Cindy?
Cindy is awesome. Cindy is like Bruce Lee. She is the baddest drummer ever. She's playing with Lenny Kravitz right now. She should be home soon.
Wow, long time with Lenny. She was playing with him.
Well, actually, he picked her up in the streets. He heard about her, you know, so I owe him for that. You know, because if it wasn't for Lenny giving her the opportunity, I would have never known Cindy.
Wow. And you married almost 4 years ago in Hawaii?
Yeah, we got married. And it was funny, you know, because I asked her, I says, what kind of music do you want to hear? Without batting an eye, she goes, Wayne and Herbie. I go, Wayne and Herbie? Wayne and Herbie? Like, man, that's two geniuses back to back. You know, it's like, who do you want to come to dinner? Like, Einstein and Hawkins, you know, like, okay. So I go, how am I going to do this? Wayne and Herbie. So the Mexican's smart, you know? The Mexican goes, why don't I call Gigi, which is Herbie's wife, and Carolina, which is Wayne's wife, and invite him to the party and says, hey, we're going to have this wedding, and we invite you. Everything's, you know, to at the Hilton and Maui and everything. Would you be so gracious to ask Herbie and Wayne if they would play? And Gigi goes, oh, he's coming and playing. She said, he's been on the road so long without me, and oh, he's playing.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And here's another piece of music from your wedding day that you danced to with the best drummer in the world.
The look of love is in your eyes. The look that charms. Sky. The look of love.
What a wonderful velveteen voice, Ronald Isley there. Yeah,
he's my favorite singer alive.
Oh my God. Here's something else that's great that has happened recently is that you're getting back together with the original members of Santana. And I read it in BAM magazine, you said to the interviewer, Kenny Ordell, that you've gone to the studio a couple of times, and so there may be an album called Santana 4.
Oh, it's going to be. Lord willing, we'll complete it in April. It's about 50 to 60%. So it was Neil Sean who kept, he stayed on me like a guided missile, you know. Everywhere I went, it was like Neil Sean and saying, hey, man, we got to do something together, man. I was like, okay. But then I decided to really honor his diligence of conviction, and I said, well, why don't we do with Greg Raleigh? Let's call Greg and Michael Carabello. So we got the whole band together now, you know.
All right, something more to look forward to. Well, let's turn things over to some cards, questions from you guys.
Thank you.
Let's see, Linda writes, do you think, hope, that someday your book will become a movie?
Only if I have the rights. No. I don't mean financially as much.
You mean the musical?
No. The consciousness. Mm. Every movie that I've seen is about tragedy, about victims. My life is triumph and victory, or save your money.
It can't be any other way. That is the story of your life. It is triumph. Writing about one's life is going back inside of it, into the past. Was there a moment, or were there moments, when you wanted to turn back around and stop writing? If yes, how did you overcome your struggle? Someka.
I always look at everything from the point of healing. Everything heals when you present it in the light. That's why I call it the universal tone, bringing my story to light. It's about healing, you know? It's really true. It's about healing, you know? It's not about gossip or, you know, anything like that. It's about healing.
The shadow of your smile. Let's see here. Pierre writes, thank you from Little Kids Rock and Mission High. Hey, what kind of student were you?
I show up for homeroom and that's about it. I just say present, and as soon as they turn around, I'd be gone.
Would you comment on your musical collaborations with Greg Rolie and how you crafted the unique sound of early Santana Band, which we'll be hearing again sometime soon?
You know, it was very, very coincidental or symbiotically happening at the same time that we were going to Palo Alto to practice, or San Mateo, mainly Palo Alto, because, you know, that's where Greg Rolie lived. You know, I didn't realize that that's where Bill Gates, Paul Allen, Steve Jobs, and Steve Wozniak were creating this vision in Santana too. We were creating a vision, and we changed the world, and it will be never be the same. You know, and they did it through technology, and we do it through vibration and frequency and music.
All right. Is there a book that has impacted your life? If so, what is it, and how did it impact your life? Evelyn asked that question.
I read daily A Course in Miracles. Mm.
Your positivity and spiritual outlook is appreciated, says Oscar. What is the most direct and simple affirmation you like to express?
It used to be, please God, help me. Now it is, I am not the body, I am free, for I still am as God created me.
Here's a question that kind of echoes something your mom, Josefina, once asked you about. Well, this is what she says, or he says, did not sign. What do you feel when you play?
I feel grateful because I feel like I can touch God's feet first and have intimacy with my wife. Mm-hmm. So when you take a solo, you need to feel something very holy, sacred, and divine. Those are the three words that you say when you're having intimacy.
Yeah, because people used to describe you as crying, you know, with your guitar and your expression, but it really was a crying of joy.
Yeah, it's more, it's not a whining.
No.
It's any whining.
Alejandrina, I believe her name is, I hope I got it right, asks a couple of questions. What other passions do you have, and will you record an album only on acoustic guitar?
No.
He stays plugged in, ladies and gentlemen. But what other passions do you have in life?
Mainly reading books, you know, Arthur Ashe, and I like read books that reveal impeccable integrity and elegance. I like to read books about people who are, you can't buy them. They're impeccable with their word, you know, because, I read a lot nowadays. I keep my mind on a leash.
Good passion to have. She also writes, what inspired incident at Daneshabar?
One thing that I really identify with is warriors. I identify with Zapata, Pancho Villa, Geronimo, Che Guevara, but not so much when he was hurting people, but when he was for a real revolution. Jesus, because he was a warrior too. But Toussaint Louverture was the name of a black general who defeated Napoleon. He defeated French, Belgians, Spanish, and English with nothing but slaves. If you ever get a chance, look up Toussaint Louverture. So it's amazing to me that we wrote about it. I mean, we played songs about him. We did a song called Toussaint Louverture, and Incident of Nishabur is where he whooped Napoleon's butt like crazy, you know? It's important that you do read about it because there's a revolution happening right now in the streets, if you can see everywhere. But the revolution for me needs to be with consciousness. For example, I invite the people who protest to dress in white so people know that you're not going to loot or break or burn. You know? Dressed in white and create big banners that says, what is the collective lesson we can all learn from this about love? Where's the compassion? You know, so that way the police know that some people are going to protest, which is your right, but they're not there to create violence or destruction, yeah. You know? And play music that rearranges your molecular structure and it helps you become courageous with compassion. Oh, here it is. This is a good one. Mm-hmm. Become courageous with compassion.
And finally, from Sama, besides turning your guitar into a snake, what is the most fun memory of Jerry Garcia?
Let's see, I was in the Panhandle, and I was into Jingo, you know, like my third time that I ever played it, and we're playing Jingo, and Mary Poppins. And I close my eyes, and I'm into it, man. I'm in it. And I open my eyes, and here's Jerry Garcia and Michael Bloomfield. And they're both going like this to each other. Like, man, check them out, you know? And I was like, dang, it's Jerry Garcia and Michael Bloomfield validating my existence. Thank you all for validating my existence. God bless you. Be kind to one another. Thank you so much.
Carlos Santana.